to lobbying for philanthropic ventures and public projects, selling ideas instead of clothes. She was, as Lasker once put it, a woman who could sell anything that she wanted to. Mary Lasker's own instruction in sales began in the early 1920s, when, having graduated from Radcliffe College, she found her first job selling European paintings on commission for a gallery in New York, a cutthroat profession that involved as much social maneuvering as canny business sense. In the mid-1930s, Lasker left the gallery to start an entrepreneurial venture called Hollywood Patterns, which sold simple prefab dress designs to chain stores. Once again, good instincts crisscrossed with good timing. As women joined the workforce in increasing numbers in the 1940s, Lasker's mass-produced professional clothes found a wide market. Lasker emerged from the Depression and the war financially rejuvenated. By the late 1940s, she had grown into an extraordinarily powerful businesswoman, a permanent fixture in the firmament of New York society, a rising social star. In 1939, Mary Woodard met Albert Lasker, the 60-year-old president of Lord & Thomas, an advertising firm based in Chicago. Albert Lasker, like Mary Woodard, was considered an intuitive genius in his profession. At Lord & Thomas, he had invented and perfected a new strategy of advertising that he called salesmanship in print. A successful advertisement, Lasker contended, was not merely a conglomeration of jingles and images designed to seduce consumers into buying an object. Rather, it was a masterwork of copywriting that would tell a consumer why to buy a product. Advertising was merely a carrier for information and reason, and for the public to grasp its impact, information had to be distilled into its essential elemental form. Each of Lasker's widely successful ad campaigns for Sunkissed Oranges, Pepsodent Toothpaste, and Lucky Strike Cigarettes, among many others, highlighted this strategy. In time, a variant of this idea, of advertising as a lubricant of information, and of the need to distill information into elemental iconography, would leave a deep and lasting impact on the cancer campaign. Mary and Albert had a brisk romance and a whirlwind courtship, and they were married just 15 months after they met. Mary for the second time, Albert for the third. Mary Lasker was now 40 years old. Wealthy, gracious, and enterprising, she now launched a search for her own philanthropic cause, retracing her mother's conversion from a businesswoman into a public activist. For Mary Lasker, this search soon turned inward, into her personal life. Three memories from her childhood and adolescence haunted her. In one, she awakes from a terrifying illness, likely a near-fatal bout of bacterial dysentery or pneumonia, febrile and confused, and overhears a family friend say to her mother that she will likely not survive. "Sarah, I don't think that you will ever raise her." In another, she has accompanied her mother to visit her family's laundress in Watertown, Wisconsin. The woman is recovering from surgery for breast cancer, radical mastectomies performed on both breasts. Lasker enters a dark shack with a low, small cot with seven children running around, and she is struck by the desolation and misery of the scene. The notion of breasts being excised to stave cancer. "Cut off?" Lasker asks her mother searchingly, puzzles and grips her. The laundress survives. Cancer, Lasker realizes, can be cruel, but it does not need to be fatal. In the third, she is a teenager in college and is confined to an influenza ward during the epidemic of 1918. The lethal Spanish flu rages outside, decimating towns and cities. Lasker survives, but the flu will kill 600,000 Americans that year and take nearly 50 million lives worldwide, becoming the deadliest pandemic in history. A common thread ran through these memories. the devastation of illness, so proximal and threatening at all times, and the occasional capacity, still unrealized, of medicine to transform lives. Lasker imagined unleashing the power of medical research to combat diseases, a power that she felt was still largely untapped. In 1939, the year that she met Albert, her life collided with illness again. In Wisconsin, her mother suffered a heart attack and then a stroke, leaving her paralyzed and incapacitated. Lasker wrote to the head of the American Medical Association to inquire about treatment. She was amazed and infuriated again at the lack of knowledge and the unrealized potential of medicine. "I thought that was ridiculous. Other diseases could be treated. The sulfa drugs had come into existence. Vitamin deficiencies could be corrected, such as scurvy and pellagra. And I thought there was no good reason why you couldn't do something about stroke, because people didn't universally die of stroke. There must be some element that was influential." In 1940, after a prolonged and unsuccessful convalescence, Lasker's mother died in Watertown. For Lasker, her mother's death brought to a boil the fury and indignation that had been building within her for decades. She had found her mission. "I am opposed to heart attacks and cancer," she would later tell a reporter, "the way one is opposed to sin." Mary Lasker chose to eradicate diseases as some might eradicate sin, through evangelism. If people did not believe in the importance of a national strategy against diseases, she would convert them, using every means at her disposal. Her first convert was her husband. Grasping Mary's commitment to the idea, Albert Lasker became her partner, her advisor, her strategist, her co-conspirator. "There are unlimited funds," he told her. "I will show you how to get them." This idea of transforming the landscape of American medical research using political lobbying and fundraising at an unprecedented scale electrified her. The Laskers were professional socialites, in the same way that one can be a professional scientist or a professional athlete. They were extraordinary networkers, lobbyists, minglers, conversers, persuaders, letter writers, cocktail party throwers, negotiators, name droppers, deal makers. Fundraising, and more important, friend-raising, was instilled in their blood, and the depth and breadth of their social connections allowed them to reach deeply into the minds and pockets of private donors and of the government. If a toothpaste deserved advertising at the rate of $2 or $3 or $4 million a year, Mary Lasker reasoned, then research against diseases maiming and crippling people in the United States and in the rest of the world deserved hundreds of millions of dollars. Within just a few years, she transformed, as Businessweek magazine once put it, into the fairy godmother of medical research. The fairy godmother blew into the world of cancer research one morning with the force of an unexpected typhoon. In April 1943, Mary Lasker visited the office of Dr. Clarence Cook Little, the director of the American Society for the Control of Cancer in New York. Lasker was interested in finding out what exactly his society was doing to advance cancer research and how her foundation could help. The visit left her cold. The society, a professional organization of doctors and a few scientists, was self-contained and moribund, an ossifying Manhattan social club. Of its small annual budget of about $250,000, it spent an even smaller smattering on research programs. Fundraising was outsourced to an organization called the Women's Field Army, whose volunteers were not represented on the ASCC board. To the Laskers, who were accustomed to massive advertising blitzes and saturated media attention, to salesmanship in print, the whole effort seemed haphazard, ineffectual, stodgy, and unprofessional. Lasker was bitingly critical. "Doctors," she wrote, "are not administrators of large amounts of money. They're usually really small businessmen, small professional men. men who clearly lacked a systematic vision for cancer. She made a $5,000 donation to the ASCC and promised to be back. Lasker quickly got to work on her own. Her first priority was to make a vast public issue out of cancer. Sidestepping major newspapers and prominent magazines, she began with the one outlet of the media that she knew would reach furthest into the trenches of the American psyche, Reader's Digest. In October 1943, Lasker persuaded a friend at the Digest to run a series of articles on the screening and detection of cancer. Within weeks, the articles set off a deluge of postcards, telegrams, and handwritten notes to the magazine's office, often accompanied by small amounts of pocket money, personal stories, and photographs. A soldier grieving the death of his mother sent in a small contribution. "My mother died from cancer a few years ago. We are living in foxholes in the Pacific Theater of War, but would like to help out." A schoolgirl whose grandfather had died of cancer enclosed a dollar bill. Over the next months, the Digest received thousands of letters and $300,000 in donations, exceeding the ASCC's entire annual budget. Energized by the response, Lasker now set about thoroughly overhauling the flailing ASCC in the larger hopes of reviving the flailing effort against cancer. In 1949, a friend wrote to her, "A two-pronged attack on the nation's ignorance of the facts of its health could well be undertaken. A long-range program of joint professional-lay cooperation and a shorter-range pressure group." The ASCC, then, had to be refashioned into this shorter-range pressure group. Albert Lasker, who joined the ASCC board, recruited Emerson Foote, an advertising executive, to join the society to streamline its organization. Foote, just as horrified by the mildewy workings of the agency as the Laskers, drafted an immediate action plan. He would transform the Moribund Social Club into a highly organized lobbying group. The mandate demanded men of action, businessmen, movie producers, ad men, pharmaceutical executives, lawyers, friends and contacts culled from the Laskers' extensive network, rather than biologists, epidemiologists, medical researchers, and doctors. By 1945, the non-medical representation in the ASCC governing board had vastly increased, edging out its former members. The lay group, as it was called, rechristened the organization the American Cancer Society, or the ACS. Subtly, although discernibly, the tone of the society changed as well. Under Little, the ASCC had spent its energies drafting insufferably detailed memorandums on standards of cancer care for medical practitioners. Since there was little treatment to offer, these memoranda were not particularly useful. Under the Laskers, predictably, advertising and fundraising efforts began to dominate its agenda. In a single year, it printed 9 million educational pieces, 50,000 posters, 1.5 million window stickers, 165,000 coin boxes, 12,000 car cards, and 3,000 window exhibits. The Women's Field Army, the Ladies' Garden Club, as one Lasker associate scathingly described it, was slowly edged out and replaced by an intense, well-oiled fundraising machine. Donations shot through the roof. $832,000 in 1944, $4,292,000 in 1945, $12,045,000 in 1947. Money and the shift in public visibility brought inevitable conflicts between the former members and the new ones. Clarence Little, the ASCC president who had once welcomed Lasker into the group, found himself increasingly marginalized by the lay group. He complained that the lobbyists and fundraisers were unjustified, troublesome, and aggressive, but it was too late. At the Society's annual meeting in 1945, after a bitter showdown with the layman, he was forced to resign. With Little deposed and the board replaced, Foote and Lasker were unstoppable. The Society's bylaws and constitution were rewritten with nearly vengeful swiftness to accommodate the takeover, once again emphasizing its lobbying and fundraising activities. In a telegram to Mary Lasker, Jim Adams, the president of the Standard Corporation and one of the chief instigators of the Lay Group, laid out the new rules, arguably among the more unusual set of stipulations to be adopted by a scientific organization. The committee should not include more than 4 professional and scientific members. The chief executive should be a layman. In those 2 sentences, Adams epitomized the extraordinary change that had swept through the ACS. The Society was now a high-stakes juggernaut, spearheaded by a band of fiery layman activists to raise money and publicity for a medical campaign. Lasker was the center of this collective, its nucleating force, its queen bee. Collectively, the activists began to be known as the Laskerites in the media. It was a name that they embraced with pride. In 5 years, Mary Lasker had raised the Cancer Society from the dead. Her shorter-range pressure group was working in full force. The Laskerites now had their long-range target, Congress. If they could obtain federal backing for a war on cancer, then the scale and scope of their campaign would be astronomically multiplied. You are probably the first person to realize that the war against cancer has to be fought first on the floor of Congress in order to continue the fight in laboratories and hospitals, the breast cancer patient and activist Rose Kushner once wrote admiringly to Mary Lasker. But cannily, Lasker grasped an even more essential truth, that the fight had to begin in the lab before being brought to Congress. She needed yet another ally, someone from the world of science, to initiate a fight for science funding. The war on cancer needed a bona fide scientific sponsor among all the advertisers and lobbyists, a real doctor to legitimize the spin doctors. The person in question would need to understand the Laskerites' political priorities almost instinctually, and then back them up with unquestionable and unimpeachable scientific authority. Ideally, he or she would be immersed in cancer research, yet willing to emerge out of that immersion to occupy a much larger national arena. The one man, and perhaps the only man, who could possibly fit the role was Sidney Farber. In fact, their needs were perfectly congruent. Farber needed a political lobbyist as urgently as the Laskerites needed a scientific strategist. It was like the meeting of 2 stranded travelers, each carrying 1/2 of a map. Farber and Mary Lasker met in Washington in the late 1940s, not long after Farber had shot to national fame with his antifolates. In the winter of 1948, barely a few months after Farber's paper on antifolates had been published, John Heller, the director of the NCI, wrote to Lasker introducing her to the idea of chemotherapy and to the doctor who had dreamed up the notion in Boston. The idea of chemotherapy, a chemical that could cure cancer outright, a penicillin for cancer, as the oncologist Dusty Rhodes at Memorial Hospital liked to describe it, fascinated Lasker. By the early 1950s, she was regularly corresponding with Farber about such drugs. Farber wrote back long, detailed, meandering letters. Scientific treatises, he called them, educating her on his progress in Boston. For Farber, the burgeoning relationship with Lasker had a cleansing, clarifying quality, a catharsis, as he called it. He unloaded his scientific knowledge on her, but more important, he also unloaded his scientific and political ambition, an ambition he found easily reflected, even magnified, in her eyes. By the mid-1950s, the scope of their letters had considerably broadened. Farber and Lasker openly broached the possibility of launching an all-out, coordinated attack on cancer. An organizational pattern is developing at a much more rapid rate than I could have hoped, Farber wrote. He spoke about his visits to Washington to try to reorganize the National Cancer Institute into a more potent and directed force against cancer. Lasker was already a regular on the Hill, as one doctor described her. Her face with its shellacked frieze of hair and her hallmark gray suit and pearls omnipresent on every committee and focus group related to health care. Farber, too, was now becoming a regular. Dressed perfectly for his part in a crisp, dark suit, his egghead reading glasses often perched at the edge of his nose, he was a congressman's spitting image of a physician-scientist. He possessed an evangelistic pizzazz for medical science, an observer recalled. Put a tambourine in his hands, and he would immediately go to work. To Farber's evangelistic tambourine, Lasker added her own drumbeats of enthusiasm. She spoke and wrote passionately and confidently about her cause, emphasizing her points with quotes and questions. Back in New York, she employed a retinue of assistants to scour newspapers and magazines and clip out articles containing even a passing reference to cancer, all of which she read, annotated on the margins with questions in small, precise script, and distributed to the other Laskerites every week. I have written to you so many times in what is becoming a favorite technique, mental telepathy, Farber wrote affectionately to Lasker, but such letters are never mailed. As acquaintance bloomed into familiarity, and familiarity into friendship, Farber and Lasker struck up a synergistic partnership that would stretch over decades. In a letter written in 1954, Farber used the word crusade to describe their campaign against cancer. The word was deeply symbolic. For Sidney Farber, as for Mary Lasker, the cancer campaign was indeed turning into a crusade, a scientific battle imbued with such fanatical intensity that only a religious metaphor could capture its essence. It was as if they had stumbled upon an unshakable, fixed vision of a cure, and they would stop at nothing to drag even a reluctant nation toward it. These New Friends of Chemotherapy. The death of a man is like the fall of a mighty nation that had valiant armies, captains, and prophets, and wealthy ports and ships all over the seas. But now it will not relieve any besieged city. It will not enter into an alliance. Czesław Miłosz, The Fall. I had recently begun to notice that events outside science, such as Mary Lasker's cocktail parties or Sidney Farber's Jimmy Fund, had something to do with the setting of science policy. Robert Morrison. In 1951, as Farber and Lasker were communicating with telepathic intensity about a campaign against cancer, a seminal event drastically altered the tone and urgency of their efforts. Albert Lasker was diagnosed with colon cancer. Surgeons in New York heroically tried to remove the tumor, but the lymph nodes around the intestines were widely involved, and there was little that could be done surgically. By February 1952, Albert was confined to the hospital, numb with the shock of diagnosis and awaiting death. The sardonic twist of this event could not have escaped the Laskerites. In their advertisements in the late 1940s to raise awareness of cancer, the Laskerites had often pointed out that 1 in 4 Americans would succumb to cancer. Albert was now the 1 in 4, struck by the very disease that he had once sought to conquer. It seems a little unfair, one of his close friends from Chicago wrote, with vast understatement, for someone who has done as much as you have to forward the work in this field, to have to suffer personally. In her voluminous collection of papers, in nearly 800 boxes filled with memoirs, letters, notes, and interviews, Mary Lasker left few signs of her response to this terrifying tragedy. Although obsessed with illness, she was peculiarly silent about its corporality, about the vulgarity of dying. There are occasional glimpses of interiority in grief, her visits to the Harkness Pavilion in New York to watch Albert deteriorate into a coma, or letters to various oncologists, including Farber, inquiring about yet another last-ditch drug. In the months before Albert's death, these letters acquired a manic, insistent tone. He had seeded metastasis into the liver, and she searched discreetly but insistently for any possible therapy, however far-fetched, that might stay his illness. But for the vast part, there was silence, impenetrable, dense, and impossibly lonely. Mary Lasker chose to descend into melancholy alone. Albert Lasker died at 8 o'clock on the morning of May 30, 1952. A small private funeral was held in the Lasker residence in New York. In his obituary, the Times noted, "He was more than a philanthropist, for he gave not only of his substance, but of his experience, ability, and strength." Mary Lasker gradually forged her way back to public life after her husband's death. She returned to her routine of fundraisers, balls, and benefits. Her social calendar filled up. Dances for various medical foundations, a farewell party for Harry Truman, a fundraiser for arthritis. She seemed self-composed, fiery, and energetic, blazing meteorically into the rarefied atmosphere of New York. But the person who charged her way back into New York society in 1953 was fundamentally different from the woman who had left it a year before. Something had broken and annealed within her. In the shadow of Albert's death, Mary Lasker's cancer campaign took on a more urgent and insistent tone. She no longer sought a strategy to publicize a crusade against cancer. She sought a strategy to run it. "We are at war with an insidious, relentless foe," as her friend Senator Lister Hill would later put it, "and a war of this magnitude demanded a relentless, total, unflinching commitment. Expediency must not merely inspire science, it must invade science. To fight cancer, the Laskerites wanted a radically restructured cancer agency, an NCI rebuilt from the ground up, stripped of its bureaucratic excesses, intensely funded, closely supervised, a goal-driven institute that would decisively move toward finding a cancer cure. The national effort against cancer, Mary Lasker believed, had become ad hoc, diffuse, and abstract. To rejuvenate it, it needed the disembodied legacy of Albert Lasker, a targeted, directed strategy borrowed from the world of business and advertising. Farber's life also collided with cancer, a collision that he had perhaps presaged for a decade. In the late 1940s, he had developed a mysterious and chronic inflammatory disease of the intestines, likely ulcerative colitis, a debilitating precancerous illness that predisposes the colon and bile duct to cancer. In the mid-1950s, we do not know the precise date, Farber underwent surgery to remove his inflamed colon at Mount Auburn Hospital in Boston, likely choosing the small and private Cambridge Hospital across the Charles River to keep his diagnosis and surgery hidden from his colleagues and friends on the Longwood campus. It is also likely that more than just pre-cancer was discovered upon surgery. For in later years, Mary Lasker would refer to Farber as a cancer survivor, without ever divulging the nature of his cancer. Proud, guarded, and secretive, reluctant to conflate his battle against cancer with the battle, Farber also pointedly refused to discuss his personal case publicly. Thomas Farber, his son, would also not discuss it. "I will neither confirm nor deny it," he said, although he admitted that his father lived in the shadow of illness in his last years, an ambiguity that I choose to respect. The only remnant of the colon surgery was a colostomy bag. Farber hid it expertly under his white cuffed shirt and his four-button suit during his hospital rounds. Although cloaked in secrecy and discretion, Farber's personal confrontation with cancer also fundamentally altered the tone and urgency of his campaign. As with Lasker, cancer was no longer an abstraction for him. He had sensed its shadow flitting darkly over himself. "It is not necessary," he wrote, "in order to make great progress in the cure of cancer, for us to have the full solution of all the problems of basic research. The history of medicine is replete with examples of cures obtained years, decades, and even centuries before the mechanism of action was understood for these cures. Patients with cancer who are going to die this year cannot wait," Farber insisted. Neither could he or Mary Lasker. Mary Lasker knew that the stakes of this effort were enormous. The Laskerites' proposed strategy for cancer ran directly against the grain of the dominant model for biomedical research in the 1950s. The chief architect of the prevailing model was a tall, gaunt, MIT-trained engineer named Vannevar Bush, who had served as the director of the Office of Scientific Research and Development, OSRD. Created in 1941, the OSRD had played a crucial role during the war years, in large part by channeling American scientific ingenuity toward the invention of novel military technologies for the war. To achieve this, the agency had recruited scientists performing basic research into projects that emphasized programmatic research. Basic research, diffuse and open-ended inquiry on fundamental questions, was a luxury of peacetime. The war demanded something more urgent and goal-directed. New weapons needed to be manufactured, and new technologies invented to aid soldiers in the battlefield. This was a battle progressively suffused with military technology, a wizard's war, as newspapers called it, and a cadre of scientific wizards was needed to help America win it. The wizards had wrought astonishing technological magic. Physicists had created sonar, radar, radio-sensing bombs, and amphibious tanks. Chemists had produced intensely efficient and lethal chemical weapons, including the infamous war gases. Biologists had studied the effects of high-altitude survival and seawater ingestion. Even mathematicians, the archbishops of the arcane, had been packed off to crack secret codes for the military. The undisputed crown jewel of this targeted effort, of course, was the atomic bomb, the product of the OSRD-led Manhattan Project. On August 7, 1945, the morning after the Hiroshima bombing, the New York Times gushed about the extraordinary success of the project. "University professors who are opposed to organizing, planning, and directing research after the manner of industrial laboratories have something to think about now. A most important piece of research was conducted on behalf of the Army and precisely the means adopted in industrial laboratories. End result? An invention was given to this world in 3 years, which it would have taken perhaps half a century to develop if we had to rely on prima donna research scientists who work alone. A problem was stated, it was solved by teamwork, by planning, by competent direction, and not by the mere desire to satisfy curiosity." The congratulatory tone of that editorial captured a general sentiment about science that had swept through the nation. The Manhattan Project had overturned the prevailing model of scientific discovery. The bomb had been designed, as the Times scoffingly put it, not by tweedy, prima donna university professors wandering about in search of obscure truths, driven by the mere desire to satisfy curiosity, but by a focused SWAT team of researchers sent off to accomplish a concrete mission. A new model of scientific governance emerged from the project, research driven by specific mandates, timelines, and goals. Frontal attack science, to use one scientist's description, which had produced the remarkable technological boom during the war. But Vannevar Bush was not convinced. In a deeply influential report to President Truman entitled Science, the Endless Frontier, first published in 1945, Bush had laid out a view of post-war research that had turned his own model of wartime research on its head. Basic research, Bush wrote, is performed without thought of practical ends. It results in general knowledge and an understanding of nature and its laws. This general knowledge provides the means of answering a large number of important practical problems, though it may not give a complete, specific answer to any one of them. Basic research leads to new knowledge. It provides scientific capital. It creates the fund from which the practical applications of knowledge must be drawn. Basic research is the pacemaker of technological progress. In the 19th century, Yankee mechanical ingenuity, building largely upon the basic discoveries of European scientists, could greatly advance the technical arts. Now the situation is different. A nation which depends upon others for its new basic scientific knowledge will be slow in its industrial progress and weak in its competitive position in world trade, regardless of its mechanical skill. Directed, targeted research, programmatic science, the cause célèbre during the war years, Bush argued, was not a sustainable model for the future of American science. As Bush perceived it, even the widely lauded Manhattan Project epitomized the virtues of basic inquiry. True, the bomb was the product of Yankee mechanical ingenuity. But that mechanical ingenuity stood on the shoulders of scientific discoveries about the fundamental nature of the atom and the energy locked inside it. Research performed, notably, with no driving mandate to produce anything resembling the atomic bomb. While the bomb might have come to life physically in Los Alamos, intellectually speaking, it was the product of pre-war physics and chemistry rooted deeply in Europe. The iconic homegrown product of wartime American science was, at least philosophically speaking, an import. A lesson Bush had learned from all of this was that goal-directed strategies, so useful in wartime, would be of limited use during periods of peace. Frontal attacks were useful on the war front, but post-war science could not be produced by fiat. So Bush had pushed for a radically inverted model of scientific development, in which researchers were allowed full autonomy over their explorations, and open-ended inquiry was prioritized. The plan had a deep and lasting influence in Washington. The National Science Foundation, NSF, founded in 1950, was explicitly created to encourage scientific autonomy, turning in time, as one historian put it, into a veritable embodiment of Bush's grand design for reconciling government money and scientific independence. A new culture of research, long-term basic scientific research, rather than sharply focused quests for treatment and disease prevention, rapidly proliferated at the NSF and subsequently at the NIH. For the Laskarites, this augured a profound conflict. A war on cancer, they felt, demanded precisely the sort of focus and undiluted commitment that had been achieved so effectively at Los Alamos. World War II had clearly surcharged medical research with new problems and new solutions. It had prompted the development of novel resuscitation techniques, research on blood and frozen plasma, on the role of adrenal steroids in shock, and on cerebral and cardiac blood flow. Never in the history of medicine, as A.N. Richards, the chairman of the Committee on Medical Research, put it, had there been so great a coordination of medical scientific labor. This sense of common purpose and coordination galvanized the Laskarites. They wanted a Manhattan Project for cancer. Increasingly, they felt that it was no longer necessary to wait for fundamental questions about cancer to be solved before launching an all-out attack on the problem. Farber had, after all, forged his way through the early leukemia trials with scarcely any foreknowledge of how aminopterin worked, even in normal cells, let alone cancer cells. Oliver Heaviside, an English mathematician from the 1920s, once wrote jokingly about a scientist musing at a dinner table, "Should I refuse my dinner because I don't understand the digestive system?" To Heaviside's question, Farber might have added his own. "Should I refuse to attack cancer because I have not solved its basic cellular mechanisms?" Other scientists echoed this frustration. The outspoken Philadelphia pathologist Stanley Ryman wrote, "Workers in cancer must make every effort to organize their work with goals in view, not just because they are interesting, but because they will help in the solution of the cancer problem." Bush's cult of open-ended, curiosity-driven inquiry, interesting science, had ossified into dogma. To battle cancer, that dogma needed to be overturned. The first and most seminal step in this direction was the creation of a focused drug discovery unit for anti-cancer drugs. In 1954, after a furious bout of political lobbying by Laskerites, the Senate authorized the NCI to build a program to find chemotherapeutic drugs in a more directed, targeted manner. By 1955, this effort, called the Cancer Chemotherapy National Service Center, CCNSC, was in full swing. Between 1954 and 1964, this unit would test 82,700 synthetic chemicals, 115,000 fermentation products, and 17,200 plant derivatives, and treat nearly 1 million mice every year with various chemicals to find an ideal drug. Farber was ecstatic, but impatient. "The enthusiasm of these new friends of chemotherapy is refreshing and seems to be on a genuine foundation," he wrote to Lasker in 1955. "It nevertheless seems frightfully slow. It sometimes becomes monotonous to see more and more men brought into the program go through the joys of discovering America." Farber had, meanwhile, stepped up his own drug discovery efforts in Boston. In the 1940s, the soil microbiologist Selman Waksman had systematically scoured the world of soil bacteria and purified a diverse series of antibiotics, like the penicillium mold, which produces penicillin. Bacteria also produce antibiotics to wage chemical warfare on other microbes. One such antibiotic came from a rod-shaped microbe called Actinomyces. Waksman called it Actinomycin D, an enormous molecule shaped like an ancient Greek statue, with a small headless torso and two extended wings. Actinomycin D was later found to work by binding and damaging DNA. It potently killed bacterial cells, but unfortunately, it also killed human cells, limiting its use as an antibacterial agent. But a cellular poison could always excite an oncologist. In the summer of 1954, Farber persuaded Waksman to send him a number of antibiotics, including actinomycin D, to repurpose them as anti-tumor agents by testing the drugs on a series of mouse tumors. Actinomycin D, Farber found, was remarkably effective in mice. Just a few doses melted away many mouse cancers, including leukemias, lymphomas, and breast cancers. "One hesitates to call them cures," Farber wrote expectantly, "but it is hard to classify them otherwise." Energized by the animal cures, in 1955 he launched a series of trials to evaluate the efficacy of the drug in humans. Actinomycin D had no effect on leukemias in children. Undeterred, Farber unleashed the drug on 275 children with a diverse range of cancers: lymphomas, kidney sarcomas, muscle sarcomas, and neuroblastic tumors. The trial was a pharmacist's nightmare. Actinomycin D was so toxic that it had to be heavily diluted in saline. If even minute amounts leaked out of the veins, then the skin around the leak would necrose and turn black. In children with small veins, the drug was often given through an intravenous line inserted into the scalp. The one form of cancer that responded in these early trials was Wilms' tumor, a rare variant of kidney cancer. Often detected in very young children, Wilms' tumor was typically treated by surgical removal of the affected kidney. Surgical removal was followed by X-ray radiation to the affected kidney bed. But not all Wilms' cases could be treated using local therapy. In a fraction of cases, by the time the tumor was detected, it had already metastasized, usually to the lungs. Recalcitrant to treatment there, Wilms' tumors were usually bombarded with X-rays and assorted drugs, but with little hopes of a sustained response. Farber found that actinomycin D, administered intravenously, potently inhibited the growth of these lung metastases, often producing remissions that lasted months. Intrigued, he pressed further. If X-rays and actinomycin D could both attack Wilms' metastases independently, what if the agents could be combined? In 1958, he set a young radiologist couple named Giulio D'Angio and Audrey Evans and an oncologist named Donald Pinkel to work on the project. Within months, the team had confirmed that X-rays and actinomycin D were remarkably synergistic, each multiplying the toxic effect of the other. Children with metastatic cancer treated with the combined regimen often responded briskly. In about 3 weeks, lungs previously riddled with Wilms' tumor metastasis cleared completely, D'Angio recalled. Imagine the excitement of those days when one could say for the first time with justifiable confidence, "We can fix that." The enthusiasm generated by these findings was infectious. Although combination X-ray and chemotherapy did not always produce long-term cures, Wilms' tumor was the first metastatic solid tumor to respond to chemotherapy. Farber had achieved his long-sought leap from the world of liquid cancers to solid tumors. By the late 1950s, Farber was bristling with a fiery brand of optimism. Yet visitors to the Jimmy Fund Clinic in the mid-1950s might have witnessed a more nuanced and complex reality. For Sonia Goldstein, whose 2-year-old son David was treated with chemotherapy for Wilms' tumor in 1956, the clinic seemed perpetually suspended between two poles, both wonderful and tragic, unspeakably depressing and indescribably hopeful. On entering the cancer ward, Goldstein would write later, "I sense an undercurrent of excitement, a feeling, persistent despite repeated frustrations, of being on the verge of discovery, which makes me almost hopeful. We enter a large hall decorated with a cardboard train along one wall. Halfway down the ward is an authentic-looking stop sign, which can flash green, red, and amber lights. The train's engine can be climbed into and the bell pulled. At the other end of the ward is a life-size gasoline pump, registering amount sold and price. My first impression is one of overweening activity, almost snake pit-like in its intensity." It was a snake pit, only of cancer, a seething, immersed box coiled with illness, hope, and desperation. A girl named Jenny, about 4 years old, played with a new set of crayons in the corner. Her mother, an attractive, easily excitable woman, kept Jenny in constant sight, holding her child with the claw-like intensity of her gaze as Jenny stooped to pick up the colors. No activity was innocent here. Anything might be a sign, a symptom, a portent. Jenny, Goldstein realized, has leukemia and is currently in the hospital because she developed jaundice. Her eyeballs are still yellow, presaging fulminant liver failure. She, like many of the ward's inhabitants, was relatively oblivious to the meaning of her illness. Jenny's only concern was an aluminum tea kettle to which she was deeply attached. Sitting in a go-kart in the hall is a little girl who, I think at first, has been given a black eye. Lucy, a 2-year-old, suffers from a form of cancer that spreads to the area behind the eye and causes hemorrhaging there. She is not a very attractive child and wails almost incessantly that first day. So does Debbie, an angelic-looking 4-year-old whose face is white and frowning with suffering. She has the same type of tumor as Lucy, a neuroblastoma. Alone in a room lies Teddy. It takes many days before I venture inside it, for, skeleton thin and blinded, Teddy has a monstrosity for a face. His tumor, starting behind the ear, has engulfed one side of his head and obliterated his normal features. He is fed through a tube in the nostril and is fully conscious. Throughout the ward were little inventions and improvisations, often devised by Farber himself. Since the children were usually too exhausted to walk, tiny wooden go-karts were scattered about the room so that the patients could move around with relative freedom. IV poles for chemotherapy were strung up on the carts to allow chemo to be given at all times during the day. "To me," Goldstein wrote, "one of the most pathetic sights of all that I have seen is the little go-kart, with the little child, leg or arm tightly bandaged to hold needle in vein, and a tall IV pole with its barrette. The combined effect is that of a boat with mast but no sail, helplessly drifting alone in a rough, uncharted sea." Every evening Farber came to the wards, forcefully driving his own sailless boat through this rough and uncharted sea. He paused at each bed, taking notes and discussing the case, often barking out characteristically brusque instructions. A retinue followed him: medical residents, nurses, social workers, psychiatrists, nutritionists, and pharmacists. Cancer, he insisted, was a total disease, an illness that gripped patients not just physically, but psychically, socially, and emotionally. Only a multi-pronged, multidisciplinary attack would stand any chance of battling this disease. He called the concept total care. But despite all efforts at providing total care, death stalked the wards relentlessly. In the winter of 1956, a few weeks after David's visit, a volley of deaths hit Farber's clinic. Betty, a child with leukemia, was the first to die. Then it was Jenny, the 4-year-old with the aluminum tea kettle. Teddy, with retinoblastoma, was next. A week later, Axel, another child with leukemia, bled to death, with hemorrhages in his mouth. Goldstein observed, "Death assumes shape, form, and routine. Parents emerge from their child's room, as they have perhaps done periodically for days, for short rests. A nurse takes them to the doctor's small office. The doctor comes in and shuts the door behind him. Later, a nurse brings coffee. Still later, she hands the parents a large brown paper bag containing odds and ends of belongings. A few minutes later, back at our promenade, we note another empty bed. Finish." In the winter of 1956, after a prolonged and bruising battle, Sonia's son, 3-year-old David Goldstein, died of metastatic Wilms tumor at the Jimmy Fund Clinic, having spent the last few hours of his life delirious and whimpering under an oxygen mask. Sonia Goldstein left the hospital carrying her own brown paper bag containing the remains of her child. But Farber was unfazed. The arsenal of cancer chemotherapy, having been empty for centuries, had filled up with new drugs. The possibilities thrown open by these discoveries were enormous. Permutations and combinations of medicines, variations in doses and schedules, trials containing 2, 3, and 4 drug regimens. There was, at least in principle, the capacity to re-treat cancer with one drug if another had failed, or to try one combination followed by another. This, Farber kept telling himself with hypnotic conviction, was not the finish. This was just the beginning of an all-out attack. In her hospital bed on the 14th floor, Carla Reed was still in isolation, trapped in a cool, sterile room where even the molecules of air arrived filtered through dozens of sieves. The smell of antiseptic soap pervaded her clothes. A television occasionally flickered on and off. Food came on a tray labeled with brave, optimistic names, chunky potato salad or chicken Kiev, but everything tasted as if it had been boiled and seared almost to obliteration. It had been. The food had to be sterilized before it could enter the room. Carla's husband, a computer engineer, came in every afternoon to sit by her bed. Jenny, her mother, spent the days rocking mechanically in a chair, exactly as I had found her the first morning. When Carla's children stopped by, in masks and gloves, she wept quietly, turning her face toward the window. For Carla, the physical isolation of those days became a barely concealed metaphor for a much deeper, fiercer loneliness, a psychological quarantine even more achingly painful than her actual confinement. "In those first 2 weeks, I withdrew into a different person," she said. "What went into the room and what came out were two different people. I thought over and over again about my chances of surviving through all this. 30%. I would repeat that number to myself at night. Not even a third. I would stay up at night looking up at the ceiling and think, what is 30%? What happens 30% of the time? I am 30 years old, about 30% of 90. If someone gave me 30% odds in a game, would I take the odds?" The morning after Carla had arrived at the hospital, I walked into her room with sheaves of paper. They were consent forms for chemotherapy that would allow us to instantly start pumping poisons into her body to kill cancer cells. Chemotherapy would come in three phases. The first phase would last about a month. The drugs, given in rapid-fire succession, would hopefully send the leukemia into a sustained remission. They would certainly kill her normal white blood cells as well. Her white cell count would drop in free fall, all the way to zero. For a few critical days, she would inhabit one of the most vulnerable states that modern medicine can produce, a body with no immune system, defenseless against the environment around it. If the leukemia did go into remission, then we could consolidate and intensify that remission over several months. That would mean more chemotherapy, but at lower doses, given over longer intervals. She would be able to leave the hospital and return home, coming back every week for more chemotherapy. Consolidation and intensification would last for 8 additional weeks, perhaps longer. The worst part, perhaps, I kept for last. Acute lymphoblastic leukemia has an ugly propensity for hiding in the brain. The intravenous chemotherapy that we would give Carla, no matter how potent, simply couldn't break into the cisterns and ventricles that bathed her brain. The blood-brain barrier essentially made the brain into a sanctuary, an unfortunate word, implying that your own body could be abetting the cancer, for the leukemia cells. To send drugs directly into that sanctuary, the medicines would need to be injected directly into Carla's spinal fluid through a series of spinal taps. Whole brain radiation treatment, highly penetrant X-rays dosed directly through her skull, would also be used prophylactically against leukemia growth in her brain. And there would be even more chemotherapy to follow, spanning over 2 years to maintain the remission if we achieved it. Induction, intensification, maintenance, cure. An arrow in pencil connecting the 4 points on a blank piece of paper. Carla nodded. When I went through the avalanche of chemotherapy drugs that would be used over the next 2 years to treat her, she repeated the names softly, after me, under her breath, like a child discovering a new tongue twister.